Blog Talk Radio.
You know, maybe this is the sole reason why we need to get on video here, because I was just rocking out to that song. My God, that just traps me. Maybe it's because I'm coming off of a concert last night that I'll briefly get into. But you are here with the Metzian Podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike. Thank you all for joining us, all you Metzian folk out there. Without further ado, we're going to get right into it. Spring training is here. Players are showing up left and right. And it's an exciting time, but before I go deep into Metzian talk, I'm going to throw it over to Mike Lecalant. Mike, welcome to a Metzian podcast for the week, and you've been singing the praises of the XFL.
Well, I'm enjoying it, you know, to put it very simply. Ever since the USFL, you know, I've been waiting for the next spring league to arise and take hold, and this may be it. You know, other leagues have come up and failed, but you knew you were looking at trash. This time around, there's quality on the field, and they're competitive games, and, you know, they're keeping interest, and they seem to have gotten it right this time versus their first launch. So let's see what happens. It's only week two. They need to sustain, you know.
And our other member of Metzian Podcast, Mr. Rich Spirago, you have not really you kind of shut the football part of your brain off after the Super Bowl, huh?
I have, and again, I know the XFL is trying something different, and that is, you know, just to have former NFL players, you know, and like we were talking about before we went on air, just have a very game that looks a lot like the NFL, which I think is right. You know, some of those gimmicky things didn't work. You know, arena football is a bit silly to me, but you know, for some reason, I just can't. The Super Bowl to me, maybe it's, you know, old dog, new trick thing. The Super Bowl to me is always closure for the NFL, and really the minute the last gun sounds, I'm in baseball mode. So, but that's me. I mean, you know, some people may want more football, and that's great. But to me, closure comes with the Super Bowl.
Mike, it seems as if as time went on, you know, baseball, which of course had always been pretty soon thereafter the Super Bowl, it's gotten closer and closer, I feel. And yet, you know, spring, you know, they've been appearing more and more closer to the Super Bowl, but at the same time, the season's going into November. It's crazy.
Well, true. I mean, both seasons have gotten extended. You know, NFL has definitely bled over the years into latter parts of January and now in February. And you're right. Baseball playoffs, I mean, once got pushed into November by no fault of their own, but, you know, they tried to have their cake and eat it too, and we're taking the season right up until the final days of October, if not the final day. So, you know, that's another discussion on what these leagues can do to perhaps contract their activities a little bit.
Rich, I know that Major League Baseball is not about contracting money, but I think at the same time, when you look at how, you know, you can figure this whole thing out from an extended season perspective, I think, you know, I wouldn't hate it if you started a 162-game season with one less week of spring training. By it seems like everybody, including the baseball players, by that last week are kind of like, all right, let's get this going now. Let's rev it up. You know, we've been here since basically the second week of February. I just think this is going to be the you know, you'd rather from an economical level get rid of the spring games as opposed to make it 154 game schedule again. And with so much talk about change in baseball, I wonder what they're thinking about when it comes to scheduling.
Yeah, you know, I'd be all for a 154-game schedule because, And what I would do with that time, I would try to lop a week off of spring training. So maybe you save some games there, and then try to end it. You make it so it never spills into November, that by Halloween it's over. But what you can do with those days, you have 8 more days, right? You could give teams an extra off. They know they're doing that now, and you could see it a little bit. But I think it make it a bit more pronounced. Give these teams a few more off days, because let's face it. Gary Cohen talks every year about, every team, if they're traveling, should have a day game. Like the last game of the series, if it's a, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday should always be a day game so they could travel. You know what? That's logical, but that's never going to happen. It's never going to happen because attendance generally isn't as good for a day game, and TV ratings certainly are not as good. So what you could do then, instead of forcing those day games, is just give teams more days off. So maybe you have a you figure it out. Maybe it's a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday series, and Thursday's an off day if you're traveling. Not certainly at every time, but you try to weave that in, and you have that flexibility to do it if you go to 154-game schedule. But we all know that's not going to happen because they want those 81 home games. Baseball wants those games because they need the gate. And there are a lot of things we could talk about. I'm sure we're going to get into it. We could talk about the wacky revised playoff format idea. That's certainly wacky. But also going to 26-man rosters, they have to pay these guys. And they're not about to start having less money at the gate. So I think we're kind of stuck with what we have.
So, Mike, do you think that Major League Baseball would entertain the idea that if they've taken the general poll, if you will, whether it's Twitter or otherwise, however they collect their information, and it doesn't seem like they're doing a good job collecting information, but that's broad stroke there. Do you think that, let's say we were like, as a fan of baseball, we collectively said, 154-game schedule works for us, we will pay you $3 to $4 extra dollars or whatever you want. $5 is probably extra $5 per game for every single ticket, we would understand where you're coming from and wherever else you want to make up that money. For a better product that doesn't seem too drawn out, and you're talking about trying to keep people's attention, one of the things that people always talk about, casual fans, is that the season is too long. They can't pay attention to it from April to October. For us, we're paying attention to it right now. We were basically paying attention to it all year long, but from a baseball perspective, we especially tune in once players start showing up in the sun before it rains of Florida. So, would you be willing to go for that? The way you go to baseball games, Mike, would you be willing to pay a little bit extra for a little bit more, and I would say, entertainment?
You certainly are headed down the right venue. The owners need to be incentivized in order to, relinquish games on their regular season schedule. They're going to have to recoup that money somehow. They're just not going to give it up willingly. Now, whether that comes out of our pockets, the network's pockets, somebody's pockets, they're going to have to be compensated, because you brought it up just before about the minor leagues and what they're trying to attempt down there. Let's not forget, everything that they're attempting to do is for the sake of either saving or generating a dollar. There's no loss there that they're, may or may not be incurring. Same thing with reducing the schedule to, say, 154 games. They're not just going to willingly do it. They're going to want to recoup that money somewhere else or in some other manner. Now, whether there's more opportunities via technology for them to take advantage of down the road, who knows? But streaming might certainly step in and give them incentives to relinquish some games on the schedule. Madman Manfred with this playoff proposal, how the hell would he fit that in?
Steal that endorsement, like, that is an endorsement of that right now.
Ultimately, something needs to give. Whether they schedule more doubleheaders you know, and somehow meet the fan base halfway. But it has to be, you know, a partnership between fan and ownership and the schedule. You know, raise prices by a percentage point or fractions of a percentage point. I don't know. You know, that's a tough call when you're paying $17 for a hot dog. I know that's an exaggeration, but I think the point is well taken. So, you know, there's going to have to be a compromise.
That's a lobster hot dog.
Yeah, but there's going to have to be a compromise on all sides. I don't think baseball ownership can just sit coldly by and say, well, no, we're not going to lose money, period. No questions asked, without any other outlet to recoup.
Rich, have you had the lobster roll, which is basically what Mike was just describing?
I have not. You know, I'm not a lobster guy, but you know, the food. I think that would be the biggest pushback, right? You know, they're going to need to recoup that money, right? They have 154 games. Conceptually, makes sense. But where do you get the money? Well, do you put a premium on tickets? Well, maybe, but what about the Pirates? You know, what about the Pirates and the Royals? They don't draw as it is. You're going to charge people more money? What do you think is going to happen? You're rebuilding. You're charging more money. And, you know, so I don't know that necessarily is a strategy. It's going to be hard. It would be hard to make up, you know, those additional. So that's four more home games, right, that each team would lose. And they'd have to get it back somehow. You know, Mets, Yankees, Red Sox, Dodgers, Cubs could raise ticket prices, and I don't think we'd all feel it if it was 5% more or whatever it is. We'd probably just do it anyway, like the trained lambs that we are. But in areas that are where it's more price elastic, you know, where it's more sensitive, I don't know. Is it going to work for them? Probably not. You know, it's probably going to have an overall net negative effect. If fewer people at the games, that would have been there anyway. So on the schedule. So, it would be hard to find a magic bullet that would work.
Yeah, what is the silver bullet with this entire thing? Obviously, we've started out with some broad strokes on a Metsian podcast, but, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, obviously whatever happens with baseball affects the Mets, of course. But the Mets have kind of, you know, consistently been in the national public conversation, and it hasn't always been specifically for the what's on the baseball field this offseason, Mike. And you know, here we are with things underway. I was happy, and let's start with something light. Why don't we start with something light? I was happy to see that entire like Noah Syndergaard pranking everybody by stealing their T-shirts, which I think was both, as you talked about before on our game notes, if you will, talking about the kind of an ode or you know, making fun of the Astros and the whole, everybody's talking about, do you take your uniform off or do you not take your uniform off, depending on whether you have a buzzer under there. But also Noah Syndergaard pitched earlier in the spring, recent spring, without a shirt on. So I think, you know, it's always nice, you know, from when looking back on the past Mets spring trainings, I always think about kind of a Tim Burdack first comes to mind with his Hulk, obviously Tim Burdack also had the little Jerry Seinfeld, but that was not spring. But, you know, you need some goofing around. It needs to be light. You know, you're getting underway. You're getting warm. And obviously that can be said for the entire season. That can be said for all of life. You need that laugh because things are going to get serious.
Without a doubt. I'm all for it. I'm all for levity. You know, that's cool with me. Like you say, it's needed. You know, who's trolling who? Was Syndergaard trolling the Astros or were Noah's teammates trolling him? You know, those are the questions. But, yeah, you know, I like to see them have a good time. But when it's time for business, you know, put on your serious face and get down to it. But for now, this is what spring training is traditionally about.
Rich, what's your favorite part when all these images start coming out? What is your favorite part of all of this?
I think it's the insights, like the whole thing with Noah's tweet the other day. I don't have it in front of me, but it's something to the effect of, you know, shirts or something, shirtless, and buzzers optional, you know. So it's getting an inside peek at their senses of humor, you know, what they are, like how they goof on each other. And that's my favorite part, you know, like seeing them. So they're doing the whole spoofing thing with the shirt thing, and then Alonzo, you know, threw a playful jab at Syndergaard, you know, and watching that whole thing, because that's the stuff that, you know, that we don't know anything about. You know, we don't know who gets along with whom, who busts on whom, you know, that kind of thing. And getting a little bit of an insight into that is kind of cool. You know, I don't know if you guys watched Hot Stove this week, but there was a clip of DeGrom, and he's, you know, walking in the outfield with a big smile on his face. He's got a big Starbucks iced coffee in his hand. And I got a kick out of that. I got a kick out of knowing that Jacob DeGrom, he's an iced coffee guy. Because we always, at least I do, ask people, you know, are you hot coffee or iced coffee? And, you know, you got a little insight into how DeGrom takes it. So it's those little things that we see that let us in on, you know, not who's hitting well and who's throwing hard and stuff like that. It's those little insights about the dyads and the triads that happen, and who busts on whom, kind of a thing, and getting to know them a little more as people.
That's what's nice about Twitter in some fashion. Obviously, there's a lot of wrong things about Twitter, but it is really, really cool how, you know, these guys can goof around, and we kind of ignore the trolls, try not to be one as often as possible. Obviously, we all have our shortcomings. We all have our trollish moments, if you will. My favorite part about the entire thing is the sun. You know, usually, obviously, the rain doesn't really come in Florida until the afternoon, which is exactly when everybody's trying to go to what's the place down there? Duffy's, Mike? Is that right?
Duffy's,
right. Yeah. And that's the spot that everybody has gone to. Mike, have you ever been to spring training down in Port St. Lucie?
Never. Never once. Never.
Boys, I'm hearing a Metsian outing coming up in 2021, but we'll have to talk about that later. Rich, I believe to the contrary for you?
Yeah, I've been several times. If it were up to me, I'd go every year. Because to me, it's kind of like, you know, you haven't been at a baseball game in 6 months, right? It's cold, you know, this winter's not all that cold, but you're ready to go down there. You get this shock of 80 degrees and sunny. You're sitting in a ballpark watching a game. Yeah, and after about the third inning, it could be a bit boring, you know, if I want to use that word, because it doesn't count the same level of, you know, angst and all that isn't there, but you're immersed in baseball, which you haven't done in 6 months. And then the other part of it that I always found to be kind of interesting is you come home back to that coldish kind of air and all of that. But then you know that the real thing is, what, 2-3 weeks away? And it just – it revs me up, I'll speak personally. The years I go to spring training, I come back, and I'm always excited for baseball season, but I'm, like, chomping at the bit when I come back because you've had a little taste. That's great. It's kind of like what the Mets are doing with their clubhouse, if you saw this, at Port St. Lucie. They really redid it, you know, and it's supposed to be state-of-the-art and all that, but they're not going to let the St. Lucie Mets use it during the season. They're going to let them go when camp is open. They can use all the facilities. But they're not going to let the St. Lucie Mets during their season use it because they want them to have that taste, you know, during spring training. Hey, this is what you're aspiring to. You're not entitled to this at single A. You saw it. You used that equipment. Wasn't that nice? Work hard, buddy, and you can get there. That's kind of my perspective. You know, you get that little taste when you go down there in early, mid-March, whatever. You come back, and you're just flying for the season. So I love it, actually.
All right, so that's a great place to go before we get into some of the personnel. But there was a little bit of a outrage culture moment with that clubhouse, Mike, because people, you know, there's a lot of controversy with the way minor leaguers are treated and get paid. So what's your opinion? I think Rich's angle is sound, and I'm kind of unsure exactly where I fall on it, but I do understand where they're coming from with that entire taste. What's your perspective?
I'm a little bit on the fence, to be truthful with you. It's a tough call. I'm not sure which way to lean. I feel both ways. I believe that, you know, minor leaguers should have to earn their way through and up the ranks and you know, achieve all those, you know, minor conveniences along the way. That's an accumulative thing. So, no, they shouldn't be given that those luxuries right away. But still, to do it and then to ban people from it, I have an issue with, you know, for the cost. I find that to be a misappropriation of funds, if you know what I mean. That's money that could have been spent elsewhere.
$57 million.
How much? $57 million? Somewhere in that neighborhood?
I believe it was. I believe it was $57 million, and I'm not sure how it was paid for.
I mean, you can modernize things and upgrade things and renovate things. I'm not going to say that that went too far, but I just don't know. I'm confused about it. I'm befuddled, and I think you can hear it. I'm on the fence. I'm not quite sure what it accomplished.
It's nuanced.
And
it's nuanced.
Say again?
I said it's nuanced.
Yeah, I guess. You know, and I don't know. I'm not so sure.
Let's go this direction. Here are some of the personnel that are going to be enjoying the benefits of that 57. Excuse me, I can't even say it because it wasn't spent on players. But that $57 million renovation. Pete Alonso, Rich. He's showing up in I believe it was a Ford truck, and I thought it was interesting video that, you know, Ford would want to jump on possibly. And here's the thing that I want to talk about with Pete Alonso, and I'll tie this all in together. last year he was gunning for a job. He made history, and now he's showing up like a baller in, you know, just this kind of modest domestic pickup truck that gets it done. talking about getting drunk as hell on a float, you know, hopefully you can pair with like an American bourbon or something like that in terms of marketing, you know. But I'm thinking big here because, and I didn't even see this with David Wright. For a long time, and all the, you know, the national stuff, when all the different players, hey, baseball's back, look what we got. You didn't see a Met. And there were times where I was like, yo, David Wright's right there, guys. Use David Wright. I know the Mets suck and aren't nationally marketable, but use David Wright. Now you are seeing Pete Alonso nationally marketed. That, you know, not only, you know, they had a winning season in his rookie year, and now he's talking about, and I think, you know, obviously you always want to hear that. You do hear that out of spring training a lot. But I think what's lovely about Pete Alonso was that he was unique with saying what he wants at the end of this season. And I thought you saw it. One of the reasons why they won 86 games is because Pete Alonso was there from the beginning to the end. We can criticize Brody all we want, but he is the one who made the decision to bring Pete Alonso up, and that was a good decision. That should be something that he gets applauded for when people talk about J.D. Davis being the only good thing that he's done. He recognized not only the baseball element of it, but also the marketing element of it. And I forget exactly who I was – I think I'm going to Rich here, but Pete Alonso, we got somebody that – the national scene cannot ignore.
That's true. I mean, you know, the Mets have the rookie of the year. They have the guy all-time rookie record in home runs. And how he is, he's national news now. I mean, he's been on all the TV shows, on late-night TV shows, and all of that. So, you know, the Mets have some cachet value now. You know, you've got Jacob deGrom back-to-back Cy Youngs. And, you know, people are asking him, you know, you're going to go for three in a row and all of that. You've got Pete Alonso. You know, you've got an emerging Jeff McNeil. You know, the Mets are, they have, they're no longer nondescript. You know, they are getting some national attention. Some of it, as you started this podcast with earlier, you know, isn't for the best of reasons, the whole Beltran thing and having to get a new manager and all of that. But at the same time, you know, the Mets are on the map now. And look, everything you just said, they won 86 games last year. If the proposed wacky playoff idea by the commissioner were to ever come true, the Mets would have made the playoffs last year. They would have been the sixth team of the seven. And so, you know, the Mets are they're making noise. They've got some individuals or they've got a good team. And yeah, it's great. I mean, it's nice to see that not all the attention's over in Tampa. You know, there's some attention in Port St. Lucie.
I forget where the Yankees used to be, but the Mets used to be in Tampa. Is that right, Mike?
The Mets used to be in St. Petersburg, if I'm not mistaken. The Yankees have been in Tampa for a long time.
And way, way back, the Yankees were in Fort Lauderdale.
Fort Lauderdale,
so
correct.
So for a hot second, guys, it was the Mets in St. Petersburg and the Yankees in Tampa?
No.
Tampa and Fort Lauderdale, as Rich says. Fort Lauderdale way back, and then they moved to Tampa afterward. If I remember correctly, the Mets were in Al Lang Stadium in St. Petersburg. Is that right, Rich?
Correct. That is right. And they basically flopped coasts. So
right.
That's a good question you raised. I don't know if there was any overlap where the Yankees were in Tampa while the Mets were in St. Pete. I don't remember if that happened. But the Yankees should be on the East Coast, Mets on the West. Now the Mets are on the East, Yankees are on the West. And whether or not there was an overlap there, I don't remember. It's a good question.
Yeah, not quite sure.
It's just the overlap would have been some fun March faux borough rivalry. You know, or whatever Tampa St. Pete is. What are they? They're two different cities, correct? It's just a metro area?
Yeah, they're at least 20 miles away from each other, I think.
Okay, so, Mike, Pete.
Well, I say that because recently I heard somebody say that Rays or Tropicana Field is 30 miles from Tampa. That's why I say
that. Okay, but it's Tampa, but they're technically the Tampa Bay. So
yeah, Twin Cities, here, Tampa St. Pete.
We're about to get into it. So when Tampa Bay region is what it is referring to when they are as a name, they are the Tampa Bay region Devil Rays. Is that right?
Yeah, they play in St. Pete and they call
Tampa.
I'm
very confused now geographically of the Tampa area.
Yeah, if I can weigh in here.
Yeah,
Tampa to St. Petersburg they're connected by a very, very, very long bridge. I've been on business in Tampa, and I went to where the Rays play, which is in St. Pete, and it's one of the longest bridges in the country, and it is quite a hike. So it's about a 30-minute ride from Tampa to where the Rays play. So everything we're saying is accurate.
Okay, so Tampa Bay is the actual bay, and that's like the Tampa area team that plays in St. Pete decided to put Tampa Bay in, just from a marketing perspective, because Tampa is more identifiable than St. Pete.
Yeah,
that's
okay. Great. Glad we got rid of that, Mr. Mike LeColant, Mr. Pete Alonso. Go ahead.
What's the guy's effervescent, you know, he's fresh, he's raw, seems to have no filter, you know, he's not a foul mouth, which I think serves him well, But, you know, he's a fun guy, and he comes across very well. His most recent comments about being wanting to be on the parade float drunk as hell, you know, that's fine. That's fine. What he did last year at the plate backs up his words and his actions and his behavior. Not to say that he's ever been, you know, out of line or has gone over the top. He's a good dude. He's a good dude, and he has a lot of respect for the game. And, you know, nothing to date has, to my knowledge, you know, struck anyone as offensive or anything of the kind. So, you know, rock on, you know. And as we said, and Rich said, you know, the Mets, we got things. We got stuff. We got a Cy Young Award winner. We got a Rookie of the Year, you know. And you know, we got stuff. So we're in a good spot.
And I want to go in that direction in a second, and how it, you know, relates to the Wilpons. But, Mike, it's interesting, you know, you're talking about how wholesome he is. But you know, he says he wants to be drunk as hell, and you know, that's, I think, understandable. And the way he says it is very, very, you know, that he can, number one, handle it, and number two, it's just, it's relatable as well as endearing. But you know, he also came up with LFGM, so he's done, like, you know, you said he's not, he doesn't use foul language, but he knows how to still, like he's the 2020, you know, he's saying effing, he's saying, he's saying drunk as hell and not, you know, other things.
You know what, he thinks he's talking to the adults in the room. And for those of us with children,
no, we're all,
it's
right,
up
exactly.
To us,
that's a great way
up
of putting
to us
it.
Parents
we're
to,
all
you know, smooth all that out. So I think it's very easy.
Yeah, Rich, you know, he's a great balance. Mike brings up a great point about all of this. You know, he's just the type of star you want, and he it comes to him naturally, it seems.
Well, it does. You know, he's got the charisma to handle it, and he's very, you know, he's very, if this is the word, unintimidated, you know, by the whole thing, and he maintains a good demeanor. He's got a good sense of humor. He's at his locker no matter what happened. You know, he's always the guy that he, for rookies, he's handling all the quotes, and he's always available. So, you know, it's one thing to have talent, and a lot of guys do, and you know, other people have won the Rookie of the Year. People win it every year, but Alonso combines that, you know, sort of a stage presence with the production on the field. And he's a gem, and the Mets have him, and that's great. You know, we should really be thankful about that, because I agree with everything you're saying. They haven't had a Pete Alonso-type guy since David Wright. What I mean by that, you know, somebody who came through the organization, somebody who handles the media well, somebody to whom the fans magnate, you know, all of that stuff. He's that guy. He's the real deal on every level. You know, homegrown Met with all those other things added to it. So, and then DeGrom is right behind him. You know, Jacob DeGrom in a very, he's not quite as outspoken as Alonso, but homegrown Met, fans relate to him. You know, solid, incredibly off the charts numbers on the field. So, you know, as Mets fans, we have, like Mike said, we have some stuff. We have some things to make us happy and proud, and that's great. We have some other things that, you know, make us not so happy and proud that we'll probably touch on as we go along. But yeah, we have some stuff, and that's good.
Mm-hmm. So, I there were so many different places I wanted to go, but I lost it, and I'm going to go exactly where you just mentioned, Rich. That's the thing. We know, like Jeff, you have done some good things. We're talking about them right now, as we speak. But the things that you've done poorly outweigh all of that, and keep us on a level that we know that we don't. I don't want to say don't deserve, But the way we've committed ourselves, the way that we are Met fans, and what you have done good can become great if there was just a little different way you went about it. And I hope this soundbite somehow gets to him at some point, but if I'm sure somebody said something to him at some point, so how could I get through to him? But that's the thing. We've got some great stuff. The Mets have always had some great stuff. But we're the butt of jokes across the nation. Whether it's Johnny Carson or Jimmy Fallon or any late-night guy you want to name. At some point, David Letterman was really making the most Mets jokes. Let's not, and he's also arguably the best that's ever done the job. But, you know, like, it was ironic when the 1996 Mets came out to do a top 10. It was very ironic because they that was one of the better moments of the Mets owning who they were. Who they are, the only way they could ever really grow, and that the Wilpons have completely ignored, is build a Marv Throneberry statue. Understand your past. It's the only way to grow from it. So, we're bringing the Wilpons up now, Mike. We have stuff.
Yeah, we got stuff already. And you know me, I love to put on my Bermuda shorts and jump into that pool at any chance. You brought up David Letterman. You know, I'd like to remind people of a guy named Jerry Girard, who was the sports guy on Channel 11 WPIX here in New York City back in the 70s. And till this day, I don't think anybody's ever, you know, pounded on the Mets more than he did back then. He was ruthless. Rich, remember him?
I do. I really do. And he was ruthless.
He was ruthless. I mean, he was enjoyable to listen to, but boy, was he ruthless. Anyway, Rich, Sam, you're right. Here we are. You know, Wilpons remain topical for all the wrong reasons. But I tell this, sometimes when we fans just need to compartmentalize. Sure, there's tons of things to, you know, go off on a tangent there. The broke down negotiations and how they're presently going. But the fact of the matter is, heading into year two under VVW and this new regime, the team is better than it was in 2018. And last year was obviously an improvement. And here we are heading into the 2020 season. And we think we just might be slightly more improved than last year's outfit. So there's that to look forward to. You know, I'm looking at the depth chart right now, and, you know, there's enough names sprinkled around both the infield and the outfield, the starting rotation and the bullpen, to make me think that this is going to be just something more than an interesting season. So, you know, Sam, cross your fingers and hope that this sale of the New York Mets ultimately and finally goes through and that we wind up in capable hands. You know, perhaps you want to throw out A-Rod being a candidate all of a sudden or potentially being a candidate. You know, but I would say, look, here we are. It's still February. You know, we have a full camp ahead of us. It's okay to compartmentalize and just sometimes deal with the players we have at hand and just, you know, assess the condition outside of the greater dilemma that is Wilpon ownership.
Rich, I want you to go from my rant and then finish with A-Rod, please.
Well, you know, how they're handling it. Well, there are so many different ways to go. Here's my angle on it. It's unfortunate that at a time when the Mets finally have their stuff, like we've been talking about, they have a good season under their belt. they're gearing up for, they should be able to build upon that season and take it to the next level. By all intents and purposes, it certainly looks like that should happen. They've got individual players who are marquee names. They're winning awards. They're personable. They've got all this stuff. But what's going on? What are people talking about? And here's the other point, Sam. People are talking about the Wilpons and how, look, do they have to sell? I'm thinking they do. I know this whole thing about if you lose $50 million or more 3 years in a row, you're required by baseball rules to sell, and the word is that they're in that situation. So they have somebody who's an 8% owner who wants to buy the rest of the team, and it's going to go, and he's going to be the one of the richest men in the world owning the Mets, and how great is that? And it falls apart. And why does it fall apart? Well, was it the Wilpons wanting control? Other people say that the Wilpons did it right and that Steve Cohen, put some conditions on the table at the last minute and that he was the one negotiating in bad faith. But anyway, regardless, the Wilpon crap is front and center, and all this nice stuff we have that we've been talking about, unfortunately, isn't. And now we're in a situation where, okay, I'm going to keep going with the idea that they have to sell by rule, and I do believe that's true from what I've heard. And now who's going to buy them? It's a freaking auction. It's a bidding war. It's like they're for sale. It's like, you have a realtor with a thing in your front lawn. The Mets are for sale. People are coming by, and they're sniffing in the pantries in the bathroom, see if they want to buy the Mets. And it's unfortunate, right? Because that shouldn't be the story. The story should be 86 wins, build upon it, all these nice pieces we have. No, that's not the story. The story is teams for sale, the owners are crap, owners losing money, all this stuff, that's the story. And that's unfortunate. And I'll use that cliche. This is why we can't have nice things, right? Because when you do have nice things, they're overshadowed. Now, the whole A-Rod thing. Please, A-Rod, be a part of the buying group. And I'll tell you why. Have a baseball man be a part of the ownership of the team. I don't give a crap about his steroids in the past. I don't. You know what? That's history. I don't care. If other people care, fine. If you want to thump the rules or whatever, fine. That's your business. I want somebody who has a baseball background, baseball credibility in the ownership group, who thinks like a baseball person, who can guide decisions and spending in the appropriate ways because of the knowledge of a baseball person. So if he wants to be part of a buying group, sign me up. And my final point is, whether it's A-Rod or not, get this crap over with. Find somebody to buy the team, and let's focus on baseball. That's my take.
Mike, with A-Rod, obviously it could go so poorly, but at the same time, I would see him flirting out him in a Mets jersey. He's been wanting this his entire life. He's been wanting to be in a Mets jersey, and he made some poor decisions that led to him not being in one. You could see the press conference with J-Lo trying a Mets jersey on. She's from the Bronx. That would be a big sell. Obviously it could go poorly. He could not run the team. But right now he is definitely attempting and doing a pretty solid job at it of changing the public perception. He's gotten either a great PR team, maybe probably J-Lo's, and he's sold me. But, it's always been a sell to me that he's been a Mets fan and has looked up to Keith Hernandez and, that it was really just his hubris as well as Scott Boras combining that didn't lead to him being a part of this, but he always seemed to regret it. I've heard of him telling me, I heard somebody tell me that they were at the Super Bowl and that they saw A-Rod on the escalator. Yeah, that's right, the escalator. And they were like, I want to say something, but I'm a Mets fan. And he was like, oh, so am I. And so there is this thing that he's always been kind of wanting to put that Mets jersey on because he bumped his head when he was, God, I forget how old he was, but it was 1986, and he was watching live the game six, and he bumped his head on the bunk bed or something like that. I'm kind of sold on it. What do you think, Mike?
I think a lot of things, you know, he's elevated himself to the status of celebrity. So if he were to come to the Mets in any kind of capacity, you know, that whole baseball pass, I don't think is really going to rear its ugly head much. Will it? Yes, but not much. thanks to his PR team, as you say, this is the new and improved A-Rod, and he's having the time of his life. What I will say about the man is I do believe he's a baseball genius. I think he knows this game unlike many, many others on this planet. I do believe his baseball acumen is superior. I really, really do. But as Rich says, he's likely to be part of a greater ownership group. If this is all, you know, true, and I guess we're going to find these things out in the days and weeks ahead, he would probably take on a role somewhat similar to Derek Jeter, who, you know, owns a very small percentage of the Marlins, but yet is the front man. And I suspect, you know, A-Rod would be in that same capacity here, maybe putting up more money than perhaps Jeter did and becoming a greater fractional owner in that sense. But I do believe the majority of the principal must come from somewhere else. Or will come from somewhere else. But he will be the front man to this. And, you know, I expect him to be very businesslike about it in his new and improved persona. And like I said, I don't think his baseball pass will be much of an issue moving forward. He's already proving that. Very few people had a better time at the Super Bowl than I think A-Rod. If you followed his Instagram and all that stuff. But, you know, I'll just reiterate, I think the guy's a baseball genius. The media circus, I don't know. I don't know. For some reason, because we're so used to him being in the limelight and the spotlight, I think that just may turn out being a non-issue. Sure. The story initially will be huge. Hey, A-Rod buys Mets, blah, blah, blah. But I think that'll all die down. And he'll eventually just be treated like another mogul and another owner. That's my take.
Rich, think about this. He can't get in as a player because they just can't get past the steroids part. But he didn't take steroids as an owner. And he brings the Mets to 10 World Championships.
But how theatrical will that be? Jeter is, you know, the face of the Marlins. He's always on TV. You know, the whole thing we're rebuilding, blah, blah, blah. Jeter's the face of it. A-Rod becomes the face of the Mets as the one of the owners. Like, he loved the Mets. You said it already. Since he was a kid, Hernandez was his idol, all of that. And he finally gets a chance after his playing days to be the biggest fish in the Mets pond. And he kind of trumps Jeter. I mean, because, you know, Jeter trumped him when he went to the Yankees. Let's face it. Jeter was the face of that franchise. He was the captain. A-Rod had to change positions, you know, to be a Yankee and all of that. And I'm sure they were buddies. I'm not saying there was any animosity there or anything like that. How would we know? But A-Rod finally... Well, he finally one-ups him, right? Derek, you're down there in exile in Miami where, you know, you can hear a pin drop in your ballpark all the time. My ownership is of the New York Mets, you know, the New York Mets, Derek, and you're down there in Miami, you know? So I just think it would be great for him. I think it would be great for A-Rod. I think it would be great for the Mets because the Mets would embrace it, the whole J-Lo thing. Could you imagine And could you imagine if the going from the Wilpons and all the crap and how unpopular to A-Rod, who, you know, oh, he loved, he's the greatest, one of the greatest players of all time. He always loved the Mets. Now he's in the Mets organization. And let's add to that with J-Lo, one of the best entertainers of all time, being part of the Mets organization. Hey, Yankees, suck on that for a while. You know what I mean? Let it happen. Come on. And you know, A-Rod loves good press. And how great would it be if he were the face of the Mets culture changing? I mean, come on. How great would this thing be?
It's
so great it's not going to happen. That's how great it would be.
No, I mean, because here's the thing, though. A-Rod dealt with Yankee fans. And he clearly knows about the Mets fans. I mean, like, you know, we're the comedians. You know, you have some comedians, Billy Crystal, I guess, what's his name? That's the sister on Tony Soprano on Sopranos. What's the other, not John Turturro, but his brother, who's a Yankee fan, who's a big time Yankee fan?
You got me.
Yeah, I
can't. Okay, well, there you go.
I think about Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker. She's a Yankee fan and he's a Mets fan, and they went to the 2000 World Series together. Her in her Yankee jacket, him in his Mets jacket. So I don't know. For some reason, I thought I would bring that up.
And if you guys are anybody out there, comedians in cars getting coffee, one of the great episodes is Jerry Seinfeld and Matthew Broderick going to Citi Field. Everybody should watch that one if you are a Mets fan. And if you were listening to this, you were definitely a Mets fan. Guys, we should move on to number 43, but before I do, Mike, I'll start with you. Do we have anything else to cover?
Oh, you know, where could we start and where would we end? So, perhaps...
the Zach Wheeler, Brody Van Wagenen stuff.
Yeah, I mean... That was interesting. If anything, Zach Wheeler started it. You know, he's like,
yeah,
that's
and
the
you
way
know
the
what?
Mets roll.
Like, we're talking about the Wilpons here, and like, Rich, does Zach Wheeler have any right to shut up?
let me read a couple. I was waiting for this. I've got a couple of quotes here, and I'll be quick. Wheeler said. He said he wasn't – so the writer saying that the pitcher wasn't surprised by the way the Mets handled it, quote from Wheeler, because it's them. It's how they roll. And then Van Wagenen comes back with, we were interested in bringing him back and communicated that, not at that level of contract. And so then Van Wagenen says after that, from top down, I feel this organization supported him in giving him the opportunity to reach major league success, Van Wagenen said. Our health and performance department, our coaches all contributed and helped him parlay two good half seasons, which is clearly a barb, over the last 5 years into $118 million. So I am proud of what our group was able to do to help him accomplish that. I am happy he was rewarded for it. And it goes on and on. But Wheeler's basically saying that's the way the Mets roll. They weren't, you know, I was too expensive for them and I was going to go. And is he wrong? He's not wrong, right? There's too much of a history of that. Van Wagenen is kind of full of shit, quite frankly, by saying, you know, first of all, if you're the GM, you're the vice president and GM, don't throw veiled shots. Don't be a passive aggressive with the guy and say we helped him parlay two good half seasons in 5 years. That's unprofessional. I don't like that at all.
It's agent talk. I mean, like when you're thinking about it, like he used to be on the side that got people the contract that Zach Wheeler was able to get, and so he feels as if he has the right to say shit like that.
And he doesn't. You know, it's unprofessional. When I read this exchange going on this week, I was like. Brody, you're embarrassing the organization. Just shut the hell up. If Wheeler says something about that's how they roll, then Brody, the only thing you have to say is Zach got his money and okay, great. That's it. End of story. Make it go away. Don't get into these veiled shots at him. Now he's going to fire back at you and what are you doing? You're the face of the organization. Don't. It's like a parent getting involved in a child squabble. Just stay above it, will you please? It really aggravated me.
Mike.
I had no problem with it. I really didn't. Eye for an eye. Wheeler started it. BBW came back.
I thought there was a nice comeback.
Wasn't it
more about the Wilpons, though, than BBW?
Perhaps, but maybe I'm just being a little giddy today, you know. Normally, I think I would find myself agreeing 100% with Rich. But today, for some reason, I thought it was fair. Zach Wheeler started, BBW ended it. Hopefully, that's the end. I don't want to see this continuing on. But if it was just that for what it was, I'm fine. I'm fine with it. At least today I am. And perhaps I'm in a good mood. Perhaps that's why.
You know, Rich, I think Zach Wheeler had a good relationship with Sandy Alderson, and I think that probably went away when he went away.
Probably. I mean, it was, Wheeler, the whole thing with I don't want to be traded, he thought he was going to go to Milwaukee, and he clearly wanted to be a Met. And I think when you hear Wheeler's comments, there's some hurt in there. Yes, he's saying it's how they roll, but he clearly wanted to stay. And we all knew that the minute the Mets got Marcus Stroman, Stroman was an under-contract guy who was going to be Wheeler's replacement because they weren't going to chase Wheeler for that kind of money. Now, whether or not I'd rather talk about this as a baseball decision, and I'm interested in both of your takes on this. $118 million over 5 years for a guy who, we'll call it a good season and a half. I'm going to go a little more aggressive than Brody, a good season and a half. But injury history. Okay. So you don't pursue him. You have Stroman locked up this year, much, much more economically. Was that a good baseball move? Forget all the crap. Was that a good baseball move? I'm asking both of you guys.
Mike, go ahead.
I would have tried to negotiate him down from 118. I certainly would have broken 100 for him, Rich. I wanted to re-sign him. I wish he was a Met today. I would have probably bent over and given them the money. Zach Wheeler said in spring training, they're going to have to meet my price. I guess he was inflexible. I don't know what kind of negotiations they had. But over 5 years, I was willing to do that. I like him. I'm a fan of his. I think his better days are ahead of him. I think health is on his side, finally. And I would have been willing to break 100 over 5 years. I don't know how much more over 100. But I would certainly try to talk him down from 118. Maybe 110, a compromise, I might have been willing to do that.
Sam?
I think you keep these guys. That's it. I think you keep these guys. Somehow, some way, you figure out how to keep the camaraderie, the marketability of the Mets have that rotation. And Zach Wheeler was a part of that rotation, was getting better. So he had a less second half year than the 2018 second half. I still think that you try to keep this core together. I guess we should also, and I'll go to you first, Rich, on this, what they replaced him with. And I guess we don't exactly know yet what they replaced him with. But Rick Porcello, I think, will be the fifth starter. What is your I love the fact that he's pumped up to be a Met, or so he says. And I don't think that's, from the PR, if we're talking about that whole PR thing, is that exactly PR or, him being genuine? Probably the latter there. I think that that's always a plus, and especially coming off of a Cy Young winner. But does that mean that the best he's been is his rookie season and that Cy Young win? Or does he have it in him to have the best as his childhood team? Rich.
Well, I'm a bit concerned about Porcello. I mean, I love the fact I went to the Fan Fest and he was great to listen to. You could tell it's genuine. He's a Mets fan and he wanted to be here and he's super excited and all that's good. But I'm looking right now at his statistics last year and I'm seeing a 5.52 ERA. And that doesn't make me feel good. You know, I know the year before Cy Young, that's great. You know, that's wonderful. But, you know, he did not. He's coming off a bad year. So it's a bit of an unknown. He will be the fifth starter. And which version of Rick Porcello are we going to get? Well, we'll see. You know, I certainly hope that that the version that we're going to get is much closer to the 17-7 in 2018 than the 14-12 with a 5.52 ERA. I mean, you know, let's be honest. I mean, you know, it's a 2016 season, 22-4. I believe that was a Cy Young season, 22-4 with a 3.15. So I hope it's closer to that, you know, than last year. And but you know, again, we just don't know. So here's the deal. Wheeler's spot is being taken by, to a degree, Stroman, you know, and to a degree, Porcello. And so you don't know about any of these guys. Wheeler could have gotten hurt on his first start. You know, you just don't know. But I would say that based on what we've seen in 2018, 2019, Wheeler is probably a bit more of a known commodity than either Stroman or Porcello. So the Mets are rolling the dice a bit, and that's what it comes down to. They have Waka in the bullpen to back up both of those guys, you know, so if anything should go wrong, they do have depth, which is great. You know, we're not going to be looking at the likes of, you know, Drew Gagneau and Chris Flexen, thank God. You know, at least the first guy up, the first man up out of the bullpen to take a spot start will be Michael Waka, who, you know, albeit not a good year last year, certainly major league credibility. So what they did was they took a fairly known quantity minus the injury potential, took a fairly known quantity, they replaced him with two somewhat unknown quantities, somewhat, and some depth. That's where we are.
Mike, Waka, Waka, Waka?
Waka, Waka, Waka. You know, it's one of those let's catch lightning in a bottle type of things. What more can you say? He was available, and you know what I always say, people are available for reasons. So, you know, there's a competition to be had for the back of the rotation. He'll certainly vie for it, but what the results are going to be, let's see. Like I said, I would have preferred to stick with Wheeler, and I think that says a lot. Waka, you know, never really distinguished himself. His name was pretty topical during the playoffs a couple of years ago. But outside of that, it's not that much to really speak of. Not impressive, not bad, but, you know, what does that mean? He's mediocre. So, you know, Rick Porcello is going to be the one, if anyone, that's perhaps going to need to step up. He's the more known of the two, the known quantity of the two, and perhaps has more expectations than Waka. But again, I hope he proves me wrong because I don't think he's going to have as strong of a season with the Mets than he did perhaps with Boston. He's always been very hittable. He's not overpowering. And I don't think that's going to play out very well here in the National League. So let's see what happens. You know, the fact that I wanted to retain Wheeler for these very reasons. I didn't think any replacement was going to be as good or better than Wheeler. And here we are.
Rich, is there anything else we need to talk about regarding 2020?
I'll throw this out just for giggles. You know, this won't take long. Rob Manfred's proposed playoff thing, you know, going to seven teams, where the team that with the best record gets to pick in a national TV show on Sunday night, the Sunday that the season ends. You get to pick the team you want to play. The first two teams have byes or whatever the hell. So you kind of like the NFL, where the wild card teams would actually host, and I think it would be a best of three in the first round, right? But the teams with the worst records would not host any home games. So it would be like you'd have the first two teams to get byes. The next two wild card teams, I believe, would be the home teams or something like that, and they would get the division winner with the worst record, and the next two wild card teams would do the home game to have the home games, and then it would be a three-game series in the first round with the other teams that qualify playing in the cities, and then the teams would pick their opponents. What do you guys think of that? Go, somebody.
I still don't know what to think of it. I still don't know what to think of it. Every time anybody throws anything out there, I'm like, what? I'm sorry. What? Go
exactly.
Ahead.
Even suggesting a bye in baseball playoffs. That's a fireable.
Are you aware? I mean, if you're not aware of it, let me try to recap what he was doing. So what he was saying is there would be seven teams that would make the playoffs in each league, right? So you have your three division winners and four more teams. And somehow there would be a bye, so that the two best records would have a bye. And then you'd have, but the math doesn't work. Maybe it's three byes. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was three teams get byes. And then you have wild card playoffs. And then Trevor Bauer shot back at him, and he said, so you basically would punish the teams that win the divisions by giving them a full week off, and they're, you know, completely off their game for a week while these other teams play a best of three. But I think what he's going for is he wants to have all these elimination games. He wants to have the national spectacle where you pick the team you want to play on TV. But then basically, if you're in a best of three, you could do it because you're not traveling. You could do it in three consecutive days. And games two and three would always be elimination games. And I guess, obviously, TV ratings are the highest for those. So you'd have a whole bunch of elimination games. And more teams make the playoffs, so, you know, more cities are interested down the stretch. But this whole thing about you get to pick the teams with the best records – get to pick their opponents, and then they get a week off, and it's just insane stuff. And I don't want to be like, you know, like a stodgy old man who doesn't want things to change for the better. I just don't see this as a change for the better.
I think it's terrible.
I think there might be something in there, possibly, like you said, like this isn't a change for the better, what you're talking about it being. But maybe there is a bat. Like, if this is what you have to do to get more people invested, well, combining with what we were talking about regarding, you know, changing the schedule and making the entire season shorter, you know, maybe that would be the incentive to making sure that people are more invested in every baseball game. Mike, go ahead.
I think the answer is already in place, just not here. Expanding the playoffs is probably inevitable. Expansion is probably around the corner, whether they're speaking about it or not. So I think the simple solution is you have the three division winners. I don't care how many wild card teams you want to include. Let them play a round robin format, and the winner takes on one of the division winners. I think it's simple. A four-day round-robin will decide everything. And, yes, that would entail one-game elimination. You can have either three wild cards or four wild card teams. A four-day tournament, done. Day five, the playoffs start. So you don't have to go a full 7 days in between series for the division winners. And, you know, I think that's the only way to have your cake and eat it, too.
Rich, you're talking about basically like an all-star break. That might make more sense.
Yeah, you know, I the point that he's trying to get across, I think, is, like I said earlier, more teams involved down the stretch, interest goes up, attendance goes up. Okay. playoff expansion seems to be the only way to do that. And yeah, how great would it have been? Here we are, Mets fans, right? How great would it have been if the 86-win season last year turned into a playoff berth? Because again, in a 7-team format, the Mets would have been seed number 6, and Arizona would have been seed number 7 last year. So imagine how exciting. Remember those games Mets played against the Marlins last week of the season? They had the Marlins in for 3, then they had, or for 4, and they split those 4. Then they had the Braves in for 3. Could you imagine how much excitement there would have been for those games against the Marlins and Braves? Now, granted, there was the individual thing that Pete was going for the record, and there was some excitement there, but that building would have been rocking because it would have been for the playoffs, right? So, yeah, I get it. I get it. I also think that there's some viability to having, you know, shorter rounds. A lot of people are against, a lot of the players are against the one-game elimination, the wild card. I was surprised to see that. But a lot of players feel, you know, do the whole angle of it's a long season, you can't decide it in one game. So maybe there's something to that. But this idea of, you know, that the team, I think it was the team with the best record gets the bye, and then the other 6 play. The other 2 division winners and the wild card team with the best record, they're the host. The other 3 teams play the 3 games in the other ballpark. And then when that round is done, then the team that had the best division winning record goes on TV, you know, their GM or whatever, and says, okay, we will pick that team. We'll play them.
No!
And then everything. So, yeah. Yeah, it's crazy, right? That's the part I don't like. That's the part that,
take that part out, you might be able to sell me on change because I'm a 35-year-old man.
Well, and I'm older than that, but I mean, you could sell me too. Take that bullshit about trying to do reality TV. That's what people are calling it, reality TV. You take reality TV out of it, and maybe you have something. But then again, listen to Trevor Bauer. You know, these guys know better than we do. Trevor Bauer is saying you're punishing the team that's not playing because you give them a week off. Look at the Mets, 2015. They swept. They had all that downtime. They lost the World Series. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, every team in the past 50 years that swept the League Championship Series, or since there's been League Championship Series play, has lost the World Series. I believe that is true. And a lot of people point to the fact that you get rusty. You know, you take that week off and you get out of your rhythm.
Daniel Murphy did not have the record anymore. Well, he still owns the record, but, you know, he did not continue the record, because he had a miserable World Series. So it's a great point to that. And that's where the compromise that Mike's talking about does sound right. It all sounds right until you see it play out. And the one game wild card seemed right until the very first game. You guys remember that? That debacle? And that's where I was always like, you know, if you're going to have this wild card, best out of 3 makes perfect sense. And you get more revenue.
That's why a round robin works because you have a loser's bracket. You can afford to lose one game.
Exactly. So, have we exhausted 2020?
I think so.
Going once, going twice. Number 43 is our official episode. We've had many specials. We're up to like 73 full episodes, but we're on number 43 from a uniform number perspective, from our official episode numbers, where we're not just focused on one specific thing, a special, a New Year's special, if you will. So today we're on number 43, and it invokes many, many names. And let's see where we're at. Obviously, R.A. Dickey is probably the first name that comes to mind, but guys, I want to start with you, Rich. When you look at this list, I mean, and it's long. We're talking 37 names here. Some names definitely pop out, but I think R.A. Dickey takes this. There's nothing. I see in 86, John Mitchell, he gets a ring, but he had it in September. And let's see if there's a – there is, yes. Jim McAndrew, of course, is a 1969 ring bearer. So, Rich, we'll start with you. Where do you go with this list?
Well, I'm going to make some quick hit comments on a couple of guys. So, Jim McAndrew, Mike, you might remember him. He always had that overemphasized sigh. Like, he would come set and really blow out this enormous breath. And my father and I would sit there watching the games and laugh because it was so over-exaggerated. So, anyway, Jim McAndrew, yeah, 69 Mets. I was a little kid when he was a Met. Into the early 70s. Mike, I don't know if you recall him, but I recall him being quite average. Like, he was not one of the better starters they had. So that's my memory of Jim McAndrew, is actually that over-exaggerated sigh that would make my father and I laugh. So, okay, so moving on. So as I look at this list, you know, I want to talk about Mike Remlinger because we all know what he's famous for. He's famous for the 1995 strike-shortened season, first game, late April, Mets are in Colorado, and they're breaking in, you know, the new ballpark, and the game goes back and forth. Todd Hundley, it's a grand slam, you know, Rockies are ahead, Mets catch up, Mets take the lead in extra innings, game goes on to like 1:30 in the morning our time, and what happens? Mets go into the bottom of the whatever inning it was, I think bottom like 13th, 14th inning with the lead, and Mike Remlinger's in there, and he gives it up to Dante Bichette. So Mike Remlinger, you know, for a bad reason, remember him. And I'll make one more comment here. Paul Byrd, I always liked, 1995 Met. I ended up with the Phillies after a while, but I always liked Paul Byrd. And I'll close my comments with Addison Reed. Addison Reed was a great pickup by Sandy Alderson. And that's another reason why I want to get this ownership thing sorted out, because what are they going to do? Are they going to add pieces in late August like they should? Anyway, we already talked about that. Addison Reed was a great pickup. He was a great setup man, the Familia. And it was unfortunate when they dealt him in 17, but the time had come. You know, they weren't going anywhere, so that they had to move him. But I always liked Addison Reed as well. And I believe that's everybody I want to comment on here. John Mitchell, very average pitcher in those mid-80s teams. Yeah, that's it. I'll leave it at that.
You know, Mike, it's interesting because you have two men here that are not known in Mets uniforms, but Billy Bean and John Givens both wore number 43 as Mets.
How about that? Billy Bean, how could you not laugh every time you see his name mentioned in Met Annals? The future genius that everyone thinks he is. Jim McAndrew, Rich, I only remember him as a San Diego Padre in his last season. But I will tell you that, you know, he was a very underrated pitcher for the 69 Mets. More of a hard luck pitcher, but he had some very, very nice shining moments for that 69 championship team. Him and Don Cardwell, very hard luck pitchers that season. You know, they put in a lot of good work, and sometimes the other opposition just, you know, pounded on them and kind of threw all their numbers askew. True story, Paul Seabert. This is right after, Rich? Black Saturday when they traded Seaver and Kingman? Black Friday or Black Saturday? What was that?
It was, you know, it was the middle of the week. But yeah, I know what you mean. It was right. Seabert came over in the Kingman trade.
Yeah, right. Anyway, it was after the trade, and the Mets were in Philadelphia. At the old Vet, and I had only, you know, just barely heard, and I heard Seaver warming up in the Mets bullpen. I was like, wait a second, what? And it turned out to be Seabert. And true story, I don't know why that sticks out, but it always does. And I was mistaken there for a moment in my childhood, and oh, man, it just killed me. Siebert. I will never forget that name. Sam, as we mentioned, Billy Beane. You know, a couple of guys who I know better their careers from other teams, like Kevin Brown and Dan Schatzer with the Expos. Let me see. Todd Pratt, how can we forget him? He had a nice day in the sun. Paul Byrd, let me see. Otherwise, you know, R.A. Dickey, Cy Young Award winner for the New York Mets. He'll never be forgotten. And the current owner of the number, Luis Avilan. Hopefully he comes through in the bullpen for us and adds to a very successful season. Take it away, Sam. John Hudak, you know what? I know him more as an independent league pitcher than I do as a member of the Mets and the Astros, I believe it was who he pitched for. But in the Atlantic League, you know, he pitched for the Long Island Ducks and the Somerset Patriots. And I follow the Ducks, and Hudak was a very familiar name in the Atlantic League.
Wow. I was going to say with Luis Avilan that, yeah, he's still a part of this team. And, you know, people are talking about this bullpen potentially being amazing if they could get it together. So that's going to be really interesting to see how it unfolds. All right, Dickie, what can you say? He's one of my favorite stories in Mets history. You know, his book is amazing. Just hearing about how he came through and finally nailed it with that knuckleball. And he was, I mean, guys, let's really, I think we're all in agreement that R.A. Dickey is the most important number 43 here, weirdly enough. And aside from, obviously, world champions, R.A. Dickey seemed to really capture this fan base in a really important way, and many different ways, especially during some losing seasons. And he has a very important story about perseverance. Rich, if I can start with you, what you remember about R.A. Dickey? Rich, you there?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you say my name?
Yes.
Can you repeat the question? I caught me off guard.
What do you remember about R.A. Dickey?
Oh, R.A. Dickey. The Cy Young season, of course, you know, 2012 turned out to be a pretty crappy year for the Mets, even though they started out well. But R.A. Dickey, you know, was certainly something to root for. And to what your point, Sam, about the book, that book was so well done. The part about, you know, the abuse he took, you know, the unfortunate stuff that happened to him as a kid, and his whole journey about how the doctor saw the picture when he was on the cover of, at least Sports Illustrated, and saw the way his arm was hanging, that he was missing the ligament, and how he took all that, and instead of, you know, basically crying about it, or, you know, or giving up on himself, he learned the knuckleball, and it really, so yeah, and he was a great personality. I guess the one thing about R.A. Dickey, I guess he wasn't as popular in the clubhouse as we thought he was. You know, there are a lot of people who, you saw that little stuff start to come out, you know, after he was gone, about how, yeah, you know, he was very good with the press, and he was very eloquent and all of that, but he was really very self-centered, and you heard some of that, which is kind of unfortunate. But, yeah, R.A. Dickey was a shining light in an otherwise dismal 2012 season. And, again, great book as well.
Mike.
The most unique knuckleball I believe I've ever seen. You know, and I remember Phil Niekro, his brother, Tim Wakefield, and a bunch of others. Charlie Huff are a couple that come to mind. R.A. Dickey's knuckleball was hard. He threw that with velocity, and that's what made it so, I guess, effective in a Cy Young season. But, you know, I'm aware of those rumors circulating around R.A. Dickey in the clubhouse at the time. But you know what? People who preach accountability often get that kind of response from the masses. You know, leaders.
And especially during losing seasons.
Right. You know, so if he was urging somebody to look themselves in the mirror, you know, sometimes that doesn't come off well, but that's what leadership does. Sometimes the best decisions are the most unpopular. And, you know, if he rubs people the wrong way.
Can I attest to a moment that I had in 2012? Coming off of a sweep of the Braves in September. I went to a private event that the Mets players bartended, and I ended up basically parlaying my night, to use a word of the evening, into clubbing with the Mets. And my night ended needing to go home in a cab, being rather drunk, more drunk than the Mets who got to stay out. But at the same time, R.A. Dickey, of course, was not there. Mac Harvey was there. Ike Davis was there. Justin Turner helped basically parlay this night for me. And that is probably what we're talking about here. You know, they split Justin Turner and Ike Davis up. That was something that was, I think, talked about in the press at the time too. And then Justin Turner parlayed that into stardom. Ike Davis, obviously, the rest is history. So, you know, that was just a very interesting point, specifically about the way these things leak out, Mike. Because R.A. Dickey, you know, in one of the things Rich, he talked about in his book at the end was, like, at some point, it might have been like a daily journal that he was taking, that he was upset that Carlos Beltran got traded because he thought they had a chance at the wild card.
Yeah, he did put that in there. And again, Dickey was someone who, from what I understand, and talking to my ticket rep, he would go in the off season. He would come in and he would make phone calls. Like, the ticket reps would call people trying to, you know, hawk season tickets, and Dickey would volunteer. He wasn't asked to do it. He would volunteer to help them. He would get on the phone and talk to people and just basically say, you know, hey, you should think about coming out, you know, doing a season ticket plan. We're going to be good, you know, all this kind of stuff. And there are stories about him engaging with people and talking about literature and some of the stuff he was interested in. So he was kind of a Renaissance man and, you know, did some things over and above, had a lot of interest over and above baseball. So, again, we weren't in the clubhouse, so what do we know? But I would say he was a good presence on the team. And let's not forget, Sandy parlayed him into, use that word again, he parlayed him into Noah Syndergaard. So it's not bad either.
And you know what? Travis d'Arnaud gave us a good amount. And unfortunately, you know, we were very vocal about him leaving. But props to him for having a pretty solid part of that wild card season for the Tampa Bay Rays last year. So just want to throw that out there, considering last spring, if you will. And before we go to our last words, Mike, I'll start with you with this. Interesting what a year can do, huh?
Yeah. Interesting what a year can do, yeah. I mean, you know. I'm just being pragmatic about it. Yeah. You know, I won't add much more to that.
Rich.
Well, is the reference on this one to d'Arnaud and how he did well with Tampa?
Well, d'Arnaud did well in Tampa. And just, I guess, the broad stroke, too, is just, you know, what a year can mean. Like how much... It's just so interesting how, you know, I almost forgot even, and we didn't even touch, of course, on Yoannis Cespedes and his potencia. You know, like I forgot that he even played in 2018. You know what I mean? And I thought, like, 2017 was the last time he played. And time is just strange that way. There's a line there's a line in LCD Sound System song that I'll quote, where it says, you know, life is short, but it feels like forever.
There you go. No, it is amazing what a year can do. And Darnell is now with the Braves, right? I believe he signed with the Braves.
I believe you're right.
Yeah, yeah, that is correct. He is in the division.
So think about that. Think about his journey. You know, he was a Met. I was at that game on that Saturday night in April where he was dreadful. I think it was three pass balls, and he also, you know, didn't do much to plate. I think he actually had a hit in that game, but he also failed in a couple of other situations, and the fans were relentless with him. And he was released after the game, and it was DFA'd after the game. Went to the Dodgers for a hot minute, right? I don't think he even played in the game for the Dodgers. And then ended up with Tampa Bay, and he really, really did help them down the stretch to their wild card run, like you said. And now he's back in the division with the Braves. I suppose he's taking McCann's spot, who retired. I think their catchers are Flowers and I forget the other guy's name. So he'll probably be competing for time as a second catcher. And think about that. You know, here he came over he wasn't a throw-in in the Syndergaard deal because he was a highly touted prospect when he was with the Phillies. So came over in the Syndergaard deal. Had a couple of decent seasons with the Mets, so he contributed in 2015. And then we just talked about the rest of the history. So, yeah, think about where his life went from February of last year till now.
He was the hook in the Ari Dickey trade. That was the main
He was the main piece.
Player in that
yeah.
deal.
So, and then everybody was
there, right?
And then there's also William Becerra. You know, we haven't even touched, of course, on the state of the minor leagues with the New York Mets going into here. And I think we'll try to do something, especially as these players start playing. We'll try to get somebody who's an expert on the minor leagues on this podcast. But, you know, William Becerra, Mike, you know the minor leagues better than anybody in this tandem. He was the other person thrown in here, and what's his status after all this time?
You know what? At the time of the acquisition, he was in very low levels coming out of the rookie leagues in the Dominican. You know, and he started well in low A, and let's just say he's like water, finds its equilibrium. You know what I mean? It finds its level. And he's not distinguishing himself as he was as a younger player. And, you know, he's in the pack right now. So he still has time. He probably has about another year left to, make a move, make some impact. Otherwise, he'll be exposed to the Rule 5 draft and he might become a minor league free agent and sign on somewhere else. But right now, you know, great things are unexpected of him. But he came in as a hot prospect, a surprise hot prospect, and impressed for a little bit, but not so much lately.
Too bad. Well, you know, I'll count Travis d'Arnaud. Two out of three ain't bad, even if it fizzled a little bit. You guys, anything else to touch on 43 before I move to the last word?
I'm good.
Going twice. Sold. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to a Metsian podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike, and we're so thankful that you have been. Rich, I'll start with you. What is your last word?
My last word is games. Games start on Saturday. Mets are on TV Saturday and Sunday this weekend. And that's a big step. You know, Super Bowl is step one. You know, football's over. You turn the corner to baseball, XFL aside. And then the next one is pitchers and catchers report. You have your reporting date. And now you're actually going to have some baseball on TV. So it's starting to get more real when it's in our living rooms on a, you know, fairly regular basis during the spring. That helps. And so there's going to be baseball, fellas. There will be baseball games on in less than 6 days at this point.